This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now it's True Wealth, presented by Little John Financial Services. Here is David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, it is that time of the week, your favorite Tuesday you've had all week, and it is time for the True Wealth Radio Show. Matt, welcome to the studio.
I'm excited to be here, as usual.
As am I. And we talked in advance today and have a very rough plan, but we're going to go with this plan, right?
We're sticking to it.
Exactly. And so, you know, we have gotten enough emails and texts and other things at the office that we have some direct response here. And it's interesting. We've had two different versions of this, right? Version one is something akin to, "Good God, man, now what?" Right?
Yeah.
That with some kind of Scottish accent to it that I did
poorly. I appreciated that, though.
Right? And then the other is the, "So, anything on sale?" Right.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to see those two broadly different opinions and concerns here. I have to admit, I was listening earlier today, listening because it's on satellite radio, to Jim Cramer, you know,
okay.
Crazy Jim. And but I did think, you know, it's Crazy Jim. He's very entertaining. At the same time, he's not stupid.
Oh, no.
I mean, he's a really sharp guy. He doesn't make every call correct, and he's part of what he's paid to do is to make really like on the spot decisions and make a call. It's still remarkable to watch the guy in action. He's a machine.
He is.
Well, he sort of divvied things up into four groups, and I don't even know if I can remember them all, but it was the different types of investors that are out there.
Okay.
Right now. And why are we opening the show this way? People are asking specifically about the markets. It started on Friday after Thanksgiving. So last Friday.
Do you want to recap kind of what happened
there? Well, go ahead, Matt. So like Friday.
So Friday wasn't a good day. Like, let's just get that out there.
Yeah.
It wasn't pretty.
All
right?
Three major indexes down around 2.5% each.
Yeah.
Right? And I like to work in percentages, okay? Because
it's a better way to do things.
Because people will say, "Oh my gosh, the Dow's down 500 points." And I go, "Yeah, but when 500 points is 1%, you know what we call that? A day in the markets, right?"
Sure.
But when it was more than that, right? But when you say, "Gosh, it's down over 2% in a day," you know what we call that? A rough day in the market.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's a material move. And you have to ask yourself sort of, well, what happened here?
Yeah,
why would the markets get beat up like that? So that's happened on Friday. And then Monday.
But wasn't Friday a short day
in
the markets?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
We'll get to that, right? Because so yesterday on Monday, markets were, you know, they kind of clawed some back, you know, about a 1% or so climb back up. And then today, another rough day in the markets.
What happened today? Recap it for us.
S&P's down 1.9%, Dow's down 1.86%, NASDAQ's down 1.55%. The Russell 2000 down 1.92%. Here's a fun one. Crude oil was up 1%. It's up to just under $67. Remember that was trading up near 85
yeah.
a week and a half ago.
Yeah.
So major volatility. Here's another interesting one. Gold up or down ever so slightly, but gold still below $1,800 an ounce at $1,774. So it's interesting. Now, the reason that gold's particularly interesting, we're going to come back to. Log that in your mind for a second. But we had a big market beat up on last Friday, and then we had a follow-through beat up today. And the markets did finish near the lows of the session. Right? So they finished weak. What happened? Well, let's talk about Friday first, because what I want to suggest is that these are not two identical markets. There's a reason for both. And it may surprise you, I'm not making a recommendation on air, right? But I'm going to suggest that if you're an investor, don't panic yet, right? There are some things to discuss.
We reserve the right to panic.
Well, I'm going to suggest professionally, we're not going to panic. We're going to be data dependent.
Ah, there we go.
But investing by its nature is long term. And what happens is when people's nerves go up, we tend to migrate out of the investment camp and into the speculation camp. Our time horizons begin to shorten,
mm-hmm.
and we start being motivated by fear and greed, and oftentimes the fear takes the lead when things are getting dicey. Right?
Dangerous place to be.
Yeah. So what was interesting about Friday? We talked about this together yesterday, Matt. Mm-hmm. Remember what I told you?
Yeah, you were mentioning that the market wasn't open the entire day. It was a short day. And we didn't have all of the people in the market trading because it was a short day, right? So the number of people trading back and forth caused there to be low volume.
Yeah, low participation in the markets. It's a holiday week, right?
Right.
And not only that, Thanksgiving is one. It's a uniquely American holiday,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's not exclusively, but it's pretty uniquely American, like the 4th of July. So here we've got this November holiday. It's the traditional kickoff to the quote-unquote holiday season,
yep.
which is a retail season, right? This is everybody buys each other gifts because we commercialize Christmas. We can have a discussion about the later, what that really means, but we're not talking theology today. We're talking markets, right? And we... So the kickoff to the holiday season, that means the markets basically took and crammed everything into days 1, 2, and 3, and then people were largely out of the office on Thursday and Friday. The markets did open on Friday for mm-hmm. a short day, right?
And there was some bad news released on Friday as well.
Well, and that's the kicker, right? So on Thanksgiving Day, we see what?
The
Omicron variant.
The Omicron variant, yeah.
Now, this we are not on this program to get everybody's feathers ruffled on this one, right? The reality is that we don't know much yet. What I am reading is that it's still a relatively small sample size. Yes, it has gotten out of the borders of South Africa, but something like 4,000 cases in an environment where the population's about 22% vaccinated. And so here we have this new variant. It may be contagious. We just don't know. And let me be real fair. I am not a virologist or an expert in this stuff. And I'm not going to come and toss my opinion around like it's fact. Okay. Let's say opinion is opinion here. The data that I'm seeing suggests that this is not a runaway train of terror. Not yet. That doesn't mean it couldn't be. So don't quote me that way. But I'm saying, hold up here. Let's wait for the data before we flip out.
Mm-hmm.
So the markets, though, don't wait like that.
Right.
Okay. News comes out about the Omicron variant Thursday. Markets are closed. So the panic that sets in, you can actually watch through some of the sentiment algorithms that are out there monitoring social media, and they're monitoring search results, and they're seeing how the spike in searches on Google, for example, for more information about Omicron. And so that triggers certain digital sell programs. And you also then have stop limit programs in place for stop losses. And you have very few market participants. Well, when you have very few market participants in a shortened day, the direction of sentiment can get a lot more severe. Because just imagine in an auction marketplace, it's like if there's only two people in a market, right? Then one person wants to buy and one person has to sell. Then the price negotiation is a lot more challenging.
Yeah.
Right? If you want to sell something, there's only one buyer, then you and that buyer and seller, you guys have to figure out the price together. And, you know, it may not be an easy agreement. When you're the seller and you've got 500 people lining up to buy, price discovery happens pretty quickly,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you've got lots of incremental amounts in between the lowest willing buyer and the highest willing buyer. And so you can kind of pick in that whole crowd of people, and it's pretty easy to sell to a big group because the demand is there for the purchase.
It's a good way to say it.
If you don't have anybody there and you've got low trading volume, then the price can jump around more aggressively or gap between this, what we call is a spread between the bid, which is what people are asking to get paid to sell, and the ask. I'm sorry, I'm doing this the other way. The bid is what people are willing to spend to buy something. The ask is what somebody is asking to get for that what they already own. So if they're going to sell it, they're the ask. Okay. The bid is who's buying. The spread, or the difference between that those two prices, is what the spread. And so that gap in between, is that if they're not the same number, right? If it's the same number, then you make the trade. But if there's a gap in between, then you don't. Well, if you've got big gaps and then somebody really has to get out, then they'll agree to a lower price and the market can jump. And that's how you sometimes see the market on open. You'll see a stock price fall really aggressively It just opens lower than it closed the day before. No, it's not a smooth line with lots of little trades falling off of a waterfall. It's just, oh, there was a dot at, you know, up high one day, the next dot's lower. The price just jumped lower. Like, wow, where did the stock really just lose all that value instantly? Yeah, it did, because there's nobody else in between willing to buy it. That, to me, is a lot of what happened on Friday.
Yeah. Okay.
Right?
And I can buy into that.
Yeah. So low trading volume, very aggressive sellers to buyers, given the news of the Omicron variant and given just the physical setups of the market. You know, a few participants, so that the aggressiveness of the trading is what drove it. And the aggressiveness was down. So Monday. Also, we should mention last Monday, intraday all-time highs for the S&P 500. So we're at nearly all-time highs for the market.
We had a ways to fall. Yeah.
And the amazing thing is now we look at it, and I want to say that it's been pretty remarkable in the last 5 days. So peaked out, let's see, that was been Wednesday. Let's go back to the 1 month or so. November 22nd hits a high, 47.93. We're down to 45.68. So what is that? A couple hundred points here. It's down like 6% or something since Monday. At the high water mark. Pretty aggressive slide.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. So what does that mean for today, right? So here we are. It's Tuesday, the 30th of November, and markets are down almost 2% again today. So, that, you know, again, they were up yesterday on Monday. Today they're down. Why?
I think they're going to have to wait till
the
break.
Yeah, we're going to take a break. We'll come back. We're going to answer that question. And then we'll get on to some other market mechanics here. But they are going to make us take an obscene profit break first. So stick around. We'll be right back. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You got True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang. Welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. And thanks for tuning in. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
Okay. We are catching up. And again, we, for our own clientele at Littlejohn Financial, we were answering a question about what's going on with the markets. If you're just joining us today, if you're tuning in just now, you can grab the podcast. If you're listening to the podcast, you already know this information, right? It'll be available at littlejohnfs.com under the Educate tab. Okay, so check it out tomorrow. It'll get posted. We talked about what drove the markets last Friday on a shortened holiday trading day, some mechanical elements at play, a COVID scare, and so the markets go down. They go up on Monday, and then here we are on Tuesday. And again, it's the 30th of November. Markets go down 1.9-ish percent across most of the major indexes. So almost a 2% drop again. And Matt, I told you that in my opinion, this is not the same thing as what happened on Friday.
Right. So if it's not based on COVID news, what do you think it is?
So today, there was testimony from Jerome Powell, the Federal Reserve Chair, right? And there was some subtle language changes that the Federal Reserve is now speaking toward. And so one of them is, for a long time, they've been using the term transitory in reference to inflation.
Do you want to explain what transitory really means?
Let's do that. Right?
Okay.
So inflation, we all kind of get it, right? You can see that gas prices have gone up and your grocery bill is going up, and we're just a lot of the consumer things that we want to purchase because of it's been argued it was supply chain disruption that causes. Now, let me explain what that means too to get this whole thing dialed. Okay. In economics 101, how does price get discovered for anything?
Just the basic supply and demand curve.
Supply and demand, right? So on the supply side, if COVID has disrupted the supply chain, what does that do to supply?
There's less supply, and so
right. So lower supply, and if demand is otherwise unchanged,
oh, okay.
Then the price would go up.
Yeah.
That is inflationary by nature. Well, the Federal Reserve has been suggesting that it's, in its view, these economic pressures have been transitory or in transition because of the interruption to supply chains due to COVID. And that as COVID subsides, they expect supply chains to loosen, and as supply sort of recovers, that prices should stabilize and normalize at that point. So they believed inflation to be transitory.
Okay.
But the language change is indicating that they see it as less, it's no longer transitory in their view, that it's sort of here and they need to do something to intervene. Now, there's a lot more to this story, right? Because we know we're still printing money in a lot of respects. And let's not go into the dynamic of how that occurs on this program today, but let's just talk about, for example, the Washington, D.C. and infrastructure spending, right? Hey, let's go have a big government spend on infrastructure. Okay, well, who builds the roads and the bridges and the things that are supposed to go into that package? A lot of private sector contractors will bid on government contracts.
Mm-hmm.
There will be things like prevailing wage provisions in those contracts. So people are going to get paid a specified wage. So those projects are going to conform to the government rules. It's going to make its way into the private sector. It's going to make it to the hands of people that are performing the works. And so that should be stimulative to the economy. But that's also inflationary in nature if the supply chain is still disrupted, but you're putting more money into more people's hands. Right. So it's stimulative in effect to the markets. So why does that affect today? What does it mean when the Fed says we're taking the term transitory away from inflation?
That means that our inflation is real. And
so
they're
acknowledging it's real. Yeah. The next thing is they have suggested they would accelerate their taper of bond purchases.
So interest rates would go up.
Well, it implies that that could be the case, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because keep in mind, it's a supply and demand thing. A lot of people misunderstand what the Federal Reserve was doing with quantitative easing, right? The Federal Reserve can set some interest rates, but the market decides interest, right?
Mm-hmm.
Turns out you, my loyal and brilliantly intelligent listeners, are going to latch onto this quickly, okay? So if I come to you and say, hey, can I borrow money? Okay, and you need to determine first yes or no. And if the answer is yes, what interest rate will you charge me, right? And some of you are really benevolent. You're like, I'd loan you money. And I would say, okay, but let's write up a contract for it because it makes our example more fun on air. And all right, so we're going to pay interest. Okay, what should it be? You're going to take an assessment of your ability to take the risk to loan the money, your need to be paid back, and my creditworthiness. How likely am I to pay you back? Right?
And where could you invest that money and get a similar yield?
Well, that's going to all come into play as well because your cost of capital and your opportunity costs. Let's come back to that. Hang on to that idea. That's a good one.
We're putting
right?
it in the piggy bank.
Okay.
We're saving on that one.
Well, you don't necessarily want to make me a really low interest rate loan if it turns out that inflation is all around you. Because you're going to get paid back in low interest dollars, and those dollars won't have as much purchasing power if everything's gotten more expensive.
Sure.
So you are at risk. Now, people forget this a lot, but when you purchase bonds, you are buying a loan, right? You're making a loan to somebody, and they're going to pay you back. That's what a bond is.
Yeah.
Right? A bond is a payment obligation so that you get an interest payment with a balloon payment at the end of the term of the bond. And what we know is that if you make a loan to somebody and then the interest rates change, the loan is less valuable if you were going to try to trade or sell that obligation away to somebody else. Like, hey, you loaned me money and then you want your friend to buy that loan obligation, so I have to pay your friend back instead of you and you're going to get cashed out of the deal. Your friend has to also assess my creditworthiness. They have to look at the change in economic conditions and whether or not they want to buy that loan. So the price of the loan may change. So your principal would be at risk. How much you get paid back isn't the issue. It's what is the value of the bond the loan you made to me, if the conditions have changed. It may not be what it started as. Okay, so that's the issue of your bond value can fluctuate. So if I'm a really good loan, you're more willing to make it to me. If I'm a really terrible loan, you don't want to make it to me. Well, if the Federal Reserve comes in and buys a bunch of bonds, that's the equivalent of, well, we will be the demand side of the curve, right? There's only so many bonds in existence. So when the government issues new bonds, the Federal Reserve comes in and buys them, and that's the equivalent of manipulating the demand side of the curve, right? Because it's only supply or demand.
Yeah.
So we demand all of it. At what price? Whatever it takes, garçon, give me the bonds.
Yeah.
And so they just buy them all. And when they do, that in effect takes the supply out of the market. So anybody else that wants to buy them, and there are times that you need to buy guaranteed obligations, right? Well, by them bidding the price up because they're willing to pay whatever it takes, then anybody else that wants to buy them has to pay those higher prices too, because they have to compete with the Fed to buy them.
Isn't that crazy?
It's crazy, but that's how it works. So quantitative easing is the Fed manipulating the supply side of the curve by being the demand. Or they're not manipulating, they're taking supply out of the curve, so they're supplying excess demand.
Mm, yeah.
Right? That's really what's going on.
It's artificial demand.
If they do that, then the price of the bond goes up, the yield or the interest rate drops. Now that, we've talked about this on the show before, but just know there's an inverse relationship between the yield on a bond and the price. If interest rates go up, your bond drops, right? Because remember, if you loaned money to somebody and then rates go up and you want somebody to buy that loan from you, they can get a new loan with better interest rates. So they're not going to pay you prime time for your loan. It's not as attractive. So the principal drops. Okay, but if rates go down, the opposite happens, right? You loan me money for 10% and rates are 5 now. People want the loan. They want to get paid back that 10% amount.
Mm-hmm.
So
they're willing to pay more for it. Yeah.
Okay. That's how that works in simple terms. So the Fed's manipulating that. If the Fed stops buying, what happens?
Well, then the interest rates would be forced to.
Demand comes out of the market, right?
Yeah.
And if demand drops, then so does price.
But then the yield goes up.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yield goes up.
And they're predicting that the yield goes up.
The market's behaving as such, right?
Hmm.
The market sort of said, wait a second, the cost of capital just went up. And so we need to readdress all this. And the Fed is saying they may change how much
buy less, in a sense.
Well, if rates go up, purchasing power is going to drop. So if anything that's leveraged,
mm-hmm.
has a problem. If you're in a floating rate event, let's say you have a margin account,
mm-hmm.
and it's not fixed interest rates, if the rates are going to change, then that's going to affect your margin accounts. Say you're trying to get a real estate loan and the banks are going to have a change to their cost of capital, they're not going to want to commit to lower interest rates in a rising interest rate environment. So the pricing of all this is going to get affected. And guess what? The market started moving really quickly. And we really, the markets may be ahead of themselves on this. They could get it wrong, right? I mean, somewhere between Omicron variant and Fed. I mean, they could be getting it wrong. The Fed may not be nearly as aggressive as the market is concerned they will be.
So, which is probably the case.
It's like, probably and here's the real kicker. And if there was one summary thought on this whole segment about what the heck's going on, again, I'm not going to make a recommendation here, but I'm going to suggest that bonds are still pretty expensive. Just because the Fed says we're thinking we may let rates start to drift a little higher, that should help reduce the amount of inflation somewhat, because it's going to take some money out of the system that's being borrowed. But is it going to take a bunch of money out of the stock market?
Yeah, I mean, is everyone
going to
leave?
Are we all going to sell and go buy bonds now?
Yeah, no.
I mean, I'm not going to go buy 0.0 nothing bonds.
I love that 0.0 nothing. That's great. I appreciate that. That's really what it is, though.
Yeah, I mean, interest rates are just nothing right now. You're skating backwards in a savings account. With inflation running where it is, you're just skating backwards. I mean, heaven's sake, Social Security is getting bigger cost of living adjustments than your checking account or savings account's generating, and most bank CDs too. So that cost of capital event is real. So if risk is mispriced, and in this case, we're talking about the risk reward trade, where you're saying, well, if I take no risk, I get no reward. but I still have inflation, then that's a misprice, right? Your no-risk event has risk, has inflation risk. Mm-hmm. And it's so high that it compels people not to stay there. So I don't know that this market is going to have all the wind come out of its sails just yet, just because it's had a couple of rough days. I think there's a little bit of a shakedown, maybe a little bit of a wait and see, a lot of speculation as to how much this Omicron variant really impacts things.
And only time's going to tell on that one.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So my sense is that the market's just volatility spiked like crazy. There was a lot more retail investors than we've experienced in the past. The Robin Hood trader phenomenon is real.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so we saw massive option volume. I was listening and hearing some of the, like maybe double what we've historically seen for the same time period. So,
and that really plays a huge effect.
It amplifies moves in the market too. These derivative trades amplify things. So anyway, my sense is that all is not lost on this point. Some speculation has driven to short-term volatility. It's knocked the markets down a little bit. There's a few big positions. We'll talk about that in a minute too, the size of positions and what that means for the markets. But I would suggest that if you are an investor, right, there's an old expression that's fun. You should be fearful when people are greedy and greedy when people are fearful. Well, the fear factor just spiked. The coming weeks, we will see where it's at here. But my sense is that trying to time the market on a 3 or 4% pullback is probably a fool's errand. So I wouldn't change your strategy. I'd just be aware at this point. If you need to change your strategy, it's because the circumstances of your life have changed. But don't let fear talk you into something foolish. All right?
Okay.
Good. Well, we got to take our next break. So
darn it.
When we come back, we will cover more. I want to talk about the big stock phenomenon and whatever one you put away in your pocket.
We'll okay.
cover that too. All right. Stick around. We'll be right back. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
We got True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang. Welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. If you're just tuning in, today's the What the Heck Happened in the Markets day. We talked about Friday. We talked about today. And Matt, then you brought up the big stock question.
Which is?
Well, so we talked a little bit about this. What was the data that we were pulling right before the show? We were looking at the S&P 500, the top 20 stocks.
Oh, yeah. We were looking at that, and we were looking at how heavily weighted those 20 stocks are.
Yeah. I like to describe the S&P 500 like a real estate grab. What happens is the biggest companies get the biggest real estate chunk.
Mm-hmm.
So there's only so much dirt out there, right?
Yeah.
And when you look at the S&P 500, here's the amazing thing.
Weren't they like the top?
The,
was
top,
it the top
three
40?
Stocks were almost 12% of the total portfolio.
Yeah, that statistic is okay. Probably even more
the
impressive.
The top 10 stocks were 30%.
Mm-hmm.
And the top 20 stocks
They're 40.
We're 40%.
Yeah.
So 20 stocks represent 40%
yep.
of the weighting for a 500 and something stock portfolio. And I say or something because it's actually more than 500
And when you
stocks.
Think S&P 500, you're thinking like these 500 companies and no, mm-hmm. like 20 of them making up that type of weighting. That's insane.
Mm-hmm.
You would think it would be a lot more diversified than that
you
in the weighting.
You would think so.
But
you would think so.
Is it the Wilkshire that is evenly balanced and
so
evenly
no,
weighted?
That's, I don't think so. The Wilshire, usually it's the 5,000 is the total market index.
And mm-hmm.
So just for our listeners' benefit here, think of it as, in this case, the index is cap weighted, right? So capitalization is how big is the company in dollar value?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So when you have a $1 trillion company, that's the $1 trillion market capitalization. Okay. If you have a $1 billion company, well, that's a lot smaller than a trillion. So, and interestingly enough, so the market cap, total market cap of the S&P 500 is 40.3 trillion.
Okay. That number doesn't even.
Okay. But if you consider that the top three companies represent about 12% of that number, well, 10% of it would be 4 trillion. right there. So about $4.5 trillion in three companies, right? And I think number four, I think it was Microsoft, Apple, and
don't tell me Tesla's in there.
No, they're number four.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, Tesla's now the fourth largest company on the planet by market cap.
That still doesn't make any sense to me.
It doesn't make any sense to me either. Oh, I think it's Amazon.
So that's right.
It was Microsoft, Amazon, and Apple, followed by... So Apple's first right now. Or maybe I think Microsoft might be first. Microsoft. No, Apple, then Microsoft,
Apple, Microsoft,
and then
Amazon, and Tesla. Where's Google play into that?
Google's
they
like
be close.
Sixth or yeah. something. They're, I mean, these are all massive companies.
Oh,
right?
Berkshire Hathaway
Facebook
was in there.
Facebook was in there. Berkshire Hathaway was in there. So there was a list, but if you there's here's the funny thing: 505 stocks in the S&P 500,
mm-hmm.
right? And
they really need to kick those five out.
Well,
make it an even 500.
They rotate a little bit here, depending. But what we know is that the biggest companies get the biggest percentage weighting. So like in, you know, Apple by itself represents like over 6%. Of the S&P 500.
And, yeah.
Okay.
And Apple had a good day today, too, I think. They were one
yeah,
of
they
few.
Were up like 1.something%. So if you think about another way to construct an index would be, well, let's give everybody the same playing time, right? Let's not just play our all-stars. We're going to give everybody the same shared equity in that. That's an equal weighting. So mm-hmm. all 505 stocks get the same percentage weighting. They get 1/500-something.
Mm.
Okay. That changes the performance metrics a lot, because what you find is that if 20 stocks represent 40% or if 20 stocks represent 40% of the money, if those 20 stocks have a really good day, they can kind of make up for 480 stocks having a mediocre day.
Yeah, but if Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, and Tesla all have a really bad day, and
yeah,
everyone else
everybody
does really
has
good.
A bad day.
Yeah.
That's it. So it does hide the what's going on in the markets a little bit. So the indexes are not necessarily reflective, but that's why we have multiple indexes. And the Russell 2000, if you'll recall, was also down today. And so Russell 2000 was down 1.92%, which is really similar to the S&P. Well, that's 2,000 companies. It's still cap weighted, but it's a lot more of the small and mid caps in there.
Mm-hmm.
So the small companies in the S&P 500 also got beat down. So it's just a good old-fashioned woodshed event.
Blistered.
Just not fun. We did see a massive spike in volatility, too. So if you measure the volatility index or the VIX, here's an interesting element to the VIX, though. They talk about term structure. I'm not going to go deep in the weeds on this, but basically the short-term volatility looks worse than the long-term volatility. All right, so the three-month volatility is looking more attractive than the one-month volatility. When you look at implied volatility in the market, which says, okay, so this event was sort of spiked on some kind of trigger, but it looks like this may come back out of the market. Bottom line, and again, I can't recommend this to you, but the indications are still that the wheels are not coming off of this market, and it's not that all was lost. Right. If you like, where else does the money go in the economy right now?
Well, and the market's also not used to this type of volatility. We've had really low volatility for a really long time.
Well, the market's experienced this before. We're not used to it. It's like we're just used to. It's like flying in an airplane and everything's really smooth and then
that's
you hit turbulence.
Yes, that's a
and
perfect
you're like,
analogy.
Like that was unexpected, and you know, I just spilled my cola or water or whatever beverage you're drinking on a plane. Some of you might be stiffer than that. The point being, yeah, it's unexpected volatility to toss you around.
Mm-hmm. So, but you're saying that the plane didn't lose any wings and the engines haven't malfunctioned.
It certainly doesn't look like it's going down.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And, you know, who knows? The thing about unknown events is, I know this is going to sound very remarkable to say, but they are unknown.
Mm-hmm.
That's deep. And so,
yeah, but as much, I mean, you're right, though. As much as we sit here and speculate, we don't know what the future holds.
No. And so we can't. And you hear me use phrases a lot about, hey, you know, statistically it looks like this. Well, why do I say statistically in front of it?
Because you can't guarantee future performance.
Yeah, it's odds making, right?
Yeah.
And what we know about odds making is if the odds are in your favor, it tends to work out well over time. You know, ask any casino. right? I mean, like their odds, I think that our investor odds are significantly better than the casino odds. I'd be willing to wager right now that if we talk to casino owners, whether they be local tribal members or they be any of the, Las Vegas or Atlantic City franchises or, Macau or wherever, we talk to them and say, hey, what if we could give the house the same odds as the stock market?
They okay. take them.
Well, they would until they said, like, yeah, except we couldn't get anybody to come anymore. Like, the gambler would lose so often they'd give up.
Right.
You know, there just wouldn't be – it wouldn't be interesting anymore because the statistics would be so overwhelmingly in their favor. And that, to me, is how it works for investors as long as you don't do – I think the technical term is stupid decisions.
That's right? A really good technical term, David.
Yeah. We've all seen it. Where, oh, I'm going to freak out because I'm getting really emotional. I'm going to do something short term.
I'm going to all gold today, David.
Yeah, you just have to check the freak out. Like, pump the brakes and don't freak out. And I'm now into even, deal making and rationalization. I want to sell everything. All right, well, look, can we sell part of everything? You will have sheltered that much. If you needed the money in the short term, it's there. Right. It's
right.
protected. It's not protected against inflation, but at least you still own assets that should appreciate over time. And now you have a bucket of liquidity that buys you the time to be patient with the other investments because historically long term, it's worked out. OK. And you know what we just did? Really basic financial planning. Right. Basic investment strategy right
yeah.
there. But what we're attempting to do is extricate you from the emotionally bad decisions you're attempting to make by making all or nothing decisions, right? Because all or nothing decisions, you have to be 100% right or you're 100% wrong.
Yeah.
Right? If you make partial decisions, we can go back to statistics, and that's about position sizing and playing the odds when they're in your favor versus not in your favor. Okay. So now that's strategy. Strategies are things that you can stick with, and it's a good way to set your emotions aside and improve your decision outcomes. Okay, so speaking of decision outcomes, not our decision, but we got to take one final break.
Okay.
So we're going to do that. When we come back, we got a few final thoughts for you, and we're going to make Matt look good. You'll see. Stick around. This is Dave Little John.
And Matt Dixon.
We got True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
All right. Hey, we've covered ground today. Check it out on the podcast at littlejohnfs.com under the Educate tab, and you can get caught up to speed. And if you find yourself going through, we just talked about how investors can make, emotionally driven decisions that can lead to poor outcomes. And if you find yourself compromised, well, you may not even recognize it. But here's the thing. That's one of the number one mistakes that people make. It's not typically the investment selection that is the problem for people. Folks often think, well, what do we pay financial professionals for? And it's for improved decision making.
That's definitely part of it. Mistake avoidance
is where much of what we call the alpha is generated, right? The outperformance comes not from asset selection per se. I mean, if you can do that, that's great, right? Great asset selection is really key, but it's really, really hard to do consistently and to outperform like the nature of an index where a cap-weighted index will invest in the companies that are growing. And as those companies grow, the weightings that they're exposed to continue to get bigger. Well, the companies that are growing for a reason. So if they keep getting bigger and they keep getting more, becoming a larger portion of your portfolio as they grow, then what you're doing is you're really biasing to the stuff that's got traction, which makes it very difficult to outperform an index. You can sometimes do it with more concentration, right? So meaning fewer positions, you might be able to enhance the returns there, but it's hard over time because that strategy is just really effective.
And the advisor is also really good about not being as connected with the decision of like when to actually sell something, right? Like you're up 10% and you want to go to 15. Maybe the advisor sees something and is like, hey, let's sell this and let's move on.
Well, or they're simply investing to the parameters that you predefined, right? Yeah. That's the real tough one, is that you get emotionally compromised when you're too close to an issue, right? We've talked on the show before about how surgeons are not allowed to operate on their own kids, right? Because they're emotionally compromised, and that can compromise your training. Okay, so that the benefit of having independent counsel that has less of an emotional stake in the outcome is really exactly that, beneficial, right? So and if it sounds like we're selling financial advice, we are. Okay, if you're capable of doing it on your own and you're good about sidestepping the emotions and following your own rules, that is a great deal, right? I mean, it really is.
Yeah.
Money management in and of itself, and the investment management, that's not the magic, right? And I'm always kind of careful when that's the first thing that somebody wants to tell you. If you walk into their financial office for advice and you start getting let me tell you how smart we are, let me give you the dog and pony show about our investments, and let me give you a story about why our investments are brilliant. If that's the lead-in, as opposed to, let me understand your circumstances, let me understand your mission profile and what you're looking for, and let me really see if we're capable of providing what you're looking for, right? Those should be the first questions that you should be receiving. Is it should be about you and your needs, and then matching to those needs, as opposed to, let me tell you why we're so great, and boy, are you lucky you walked in my office. Right? Anyway, there's one last thing on my list.
What do you got on your mind?
Well, the last one is the funny thing about this program. I mean, I recognize that we are out there in the marketplace, so we're competing for clients like everybody else. And yes, we are still taking on new customers. So you can call us, and we're delighted to work with you but we're not. My mission has never been to convince you to leave an existing relationship. If you've got a great professional relationship with somebody, that's fine. I think there's a lot of great practitioners out there, and it's about just make sure that you do get the help. Because what happens is, this is the stuff that oftentimes falls onto the important but not urgent stack, right? And you don't get to it. And it's the difference is, right, if you don't change your oil after a long enough time, problems develop, okay? The issue is that if you don't address your finances after enough time, problems can develop, but you don't have the time to fix them. Time is the part of the asset equation, right? Yeah. Without the time, it's a lot harder to make up the assets. And so you need that time to build. So I'm just encouraging everybody, if you don't have somebody, call us, right? 541-375-0898. If you do have somebody, fantastic. But just don't stall out on the decisions. Okay, that's a bummer deal. You don't want to do that. And I've had so many people that look back and go, "Oh man, woulda, shoulda, coulda." I know. And you know who ends up being successful a lot of the time? Public sector employees, because they don't get a choice. This is your benefit package. It's happening.
Yeah.
Okay. And there are trade-offs for that. And there are different rules and different things that are good and bad. But that investment strategy is force-fed. Okay. And in the private sector, it doesn't happen that way often. You have to sort of elect it. So I'm just really trying to get on the soapbox for a minute and say, doggone it, eat your vegetables. Do the right thing here.
Yeah.
Okay. One final thing I'm just going to mention, because if we miss it, it's relevant. And that is, did you see what happened in the mortgage marketplace today?
What happened?
So they have increased the conforming loan limits for your federal housing and financing agencies, right? So like Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and so forth, they're
willing to loan you more money on a home.
Correct. Well, this is essentially an acknowledgement of inflation in the real estate.
But how much did they raise it by?
$98,950.
Ooh, that is a jump.
So yeah, the new conforming loan limit is $647,200. And in some markets, it's higher than that. So like in places like California, I think, and New York and some other places, they can, I'm looking, established loan limits are higher for Alaska, Hawaii, Guam, and the Virgin Islands and some others.
But a percent, what type of jump are we looking at here?
Oh, gosh, that's high. I mean, that's close. It's an 18.05% increase.
Wow.
So that is, now, presumably that's because if the real estate market has increased in value, the underlying collateral has increased as well. So they can.
I wonder what the effect on the real estate market might be from that.
My suspicion is that it's about a push because on the one hand, if rates are going to go higher, you're going to have less purchasing power. But for folks that found themselves on the fringe of properties where maybe they couldn't borrow enough to get there because they'd have to get into a jumbo mortgage and the rules were just too cumbersome to get there, it's going to give a little bit more headroom to the housing market for the average buyer, which gives more pricing upside potential. On the flip side, reduction in purchasing power, but we're seeing wage inflation too. So, you know, there's multiple levers that are getting pulled here. And I don't know the outcome, but my suspicion is that it prevents a housing market collapse that we may have, like we saw in 2008. Doesn't mean we can't have a pullback, but, you know, seeing a 50% drop in real estate prices looks less probable given the data. Did we go back to statistics again?
We're all over the place, David.
I live in stats land. I'm just such a loser. I just can't help us numbers guys go find comfort in the numbers and this inability to commit to them, right? Well, let me just, it's mostly like this, except for the times when it's not.
I'm going to get you like a math equations book for Christmas.
I neither love spreadsheets nor want to play in the statistics. I just like to see them when they're already calculated.
Okay.
We're out of time, gang. We got to run. Thanks for tuning in, as always. This has been Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And if you want to reach us, it's Littlejohn Financial, 541-375-0898. Until next time, thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
The preceding program was paid for by Littlejohn Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.